Hi, and welcome to the Dr. Robin Show. We bring you the latest medical info and stories. I'm a doctor, and this is a real medical show. We don't sell anything on the program. My co-host is social worker Susie Robbins. You can email us at doclarryrobbins@aol.com. We have an exciting showgram today that includes older people lifting weights, the pluses and minuses, Heelys causing injuries, the question of, does your doctor's attire really matter? Depression in people with heart disease? Heavy metals contamination? We'll talk about some herbal products, good and bad, and a whole lot more. How about we start with seniors pumping iron? Our first study focuses on sort of a self-obvious study indicating that seniors who pump iron build up muscle and get rid of fat. But it's nice to prove. This was actually an Austrian study from a few weeks ago that showed that pumping iron in seniors builds muscle and does lower fat levels. The average age in the study actually was 76, so it's never too old to start pumping iron. After 3 months, they had gained an average of 6 pounds of muscle and lost 8 pounds of fat. It was a lot of pumping iron, 2 hours a week of pumping iron. Most people won't do that much. Women at age 76 were just as strong as the men, interestingly enough, in this study. So the bottom line is that pumping iron is good for young and good for old. Now, Susie, you do the type of weightlifting where they do it very, very slow for half an hour, just once a week. But I think that's been good for a lot of people. What do you think?
Well, I actually do do weights once a week. I could probably do it more often, but at this point I'm doing what's called slow movement, and that is where I work with somebody. There's a trainer there, and she makes sure that I am doing the amount of repetitions. It's really based on time, not how many repetitions you do, but how long you can actually sustain the weight. And what's really important about really using the weights correctly is to do it based on your own strength and not momentum. So, you know, you might be at the health club sometime and you see somebody with weights and they're jerking them back quickly, back and forth. Slow movement really disagrees with that technique and says that what you need to do is to do the weights slowly and to get more out of it by actually using your muscles.
You know, I'm one of the faster, jerkier types. I think it depends on your personality. I know it's not good to do it fast, but I have to do it quick. And but I think the slower you do weights in general, of course, the better, and the trainers always tell you that. I think one thing about weightlifting, it's very motivating because quickly, within a week or two, you feel the firmness, and you can feel your muscles, and you can see it in the mirror. So it's motivating, unlike even cardio, where it can take a long time or you don't really necessarily see anything different, although you do eventually. I think lifting weights is good. And I'm always trying to get people in my practice to motivate themselves to do something. 5 minutes a day of exercise is better than zero. And we're trying to average 15 or 20 minutes a day. So even 5 minutes twice a week of some weights. Or if somebody's on a bike, they can multitask. We're all used to multitasking in our crazy country here in the U.S. And if you have 5 or 10 pound weights and you're on a bike or on a treadmill, you can do a little weight. It's not ideal, but it's better than nothing. Of course, you have to be careful not to fall off a treadmill. Sometimes I'm multitasking too much. I'm reading, lifting weights, and all of a sudden you can go backwards. I have found a really good website that's free, actually, for diet and motivation and exercise. It's Spark People, S-P-A-R-K, people.com. I think there's a couple million people who've signed up. You get daily emails, and it's great. I'll get an email, for instance, how to fit in exercise for really busy people. Or on Friday, I'll get a couple emails, how not to pig out this weekend. Or before Super Bowl, you know, how to go to a party and not eat 8 million calories. So stuff like that is motivating. And over the years, I've noticed people get into exercise and diet and everything, and then they get out of it. And when they're out of it, it's 20, 30 pounds. And the idea is, how do we get back into it? And I think these websites and reading magazines and things help as far as motivation. Now, Susie, you've been weightlifting, you mentioned. What's your motivation for weightlifting? We're trying to build up big pipes, or why did you get into weightlifting?
Well, first of all, even if I kept trying forever, I don't think I'd really be able to get those big pipes. I think most people that do weightlifting at some point, their body plateaus in terms of how much muscle they can really, really build up. But I got into it after I was told by my doctor that I had osteopenia, which is pre-osteoporosis, and that one of the best things that I could do for myself was to start using weights, to start building those bones up. And so that's really what got me into it. Not that, you know, it was something that I thought would be fun, although I really look forward to going every week, but I do it for my bones. And as you mentioned earlier in the show, that this article is out about seniors lifting weights, and boy, I can't think of a better thing for seniors to be doing in terms of keeping their bones strong for both men and women.
You know, you mentioned building up big pipes. We could always do it by taking steroids, and I say that offhandedly, but you know, it's not just pro athletes. As you know, a lot of college athletes are taking steroids, high school athletes, and what I've seen more and more is non-athletes, just kids who for self-esteem want to get big. They're 17 years old and they're shooting roids, which is crazy. So that's a subject for another show. Susie, anything else?
Well, you know, maybe some people do not seem too turned on about doing weights, and you know, that's okay. Or maybe, you know, they don't have time to go to a gym to do it. But if you're thinking about your bones and your overall long-term health, walking is also an excellent way to keep your bones strong. Walking every day, walking every other day, as much as you can. It's that continual walking and putting that weight down as you move. Biking is great cardio, but at least what I've been told by my doctor and what I've read is that walking is actually even better to keep your bones strong than riding a bike.
You know, it's interesting. There's a study going on. Now they have about 6,000 people, I believe, out of a university on people who've kept weight off for at least 5 years. And they ask them what they do, and it seems that all the people do the same things. People who keep weight off long-term seem to follow themselves into similar patterns. They all watch their calories or points. They weigh themselves often. Portion control is crucial. Nobody's dieting. They tend to eat low fat. But one thing is they exercise a lot, 40, 50 minutes a day, and walking is the most popular exercise in that great group who's kept weight off. So I think that getting a headset or an iPod and walking is the best. It's just when it's really bad out and bad weather and winter, if you're in northern climes, having something inside, a bike, treadmill, can really help. Now in our next piece, researchers have evaluated the effect of depression and anxiety and anger on hardening of the arteries or atherosclerosis. And it's an interesting topic because we always think of depression, anxiety as just a quality of life issue. So if we treat it or we don't treat it, well, people will live just as long. But that may not be true. This was a 3-year study from ages 50 to 70, and depression did indeed increase hardening of the arteries, but anxiety and anger did not. Now, previous studies have indicated that anger is a risk factor for heart attacks anyways, maybe not through hardening of the arteries, but in this study, depression was the worst. So, depression is not just about quality of life. It also has serious physical consequences, so we need to treat it. And it goes along with previous studies that did increase, indicate that depression increases mortality, the risk of dying younger. This really makes a strong, strong case for treating depression. And then we can talk about how do you treat depression. I'll go over to my co-host, Susie Robbins. What do you think?
Well, I think therapy is always can always be applicable to, you know, people that need some support and are going through difficult times. Specifically with depression, yes, I think it's very important, but I think for someone suffering from depression, medicine is also just as important.
Yeah, it's usually the combination of medicine and therapy. The problem with therapy is I give a lot of referrals, but very many people don't go because of money and time, both of which are very legitimate excuses. Although, interestingly enough, studies have shown on depression that if you get in with a therapist once or twice and then do it on the phone once a week, they did a couple good studies on phone counseling for depression. It works just as well. Actually, one study worked better than going in because it's easier on the phone. People have less missed appointments. So we're always trying to get people into therapy. As far as meds, the antidepressants work for 60 to 70% of people. And there's a lot of newer ones. There's a lot of older ones. So it depends on what people can tolerate. But we do try to get people on one of the newer medications, such as Cymbalta, Lexapro, even Prozac, Zoloft. They're not so new anymore because these generally have less side effects than the ones that were around 25 years ago. We'll talk more about depression medicines later, and we've talked about it quite a bit on this program in the past. Outside of therapy and taking medicines, exercise is always useful for depression. I don't think it's a great miracle, but for some people it helps pick up energy. And having a support system is crucial. People who are not as isolated do better. But we face the problem in this country. I think we're increasingly becoming isolated with a mobile country, with email and internet, and people just sitting there on their computer. People have less reason to talk on the phone and actually connect and see people. And, you know, it's the old law of unintended consequences. We got all this great stuff with email and the internet and a mobile society. But at the end of the day, when we look around, maybe we're more depressed and more isolated because of it all. More on that later. Now, you know, on another topic, a story from an emergency room in Belfast, Ireland, talks about the injuries that come from heelys. Now, heelys are these newfangled shoes with a little roller blade in the heel so kids can walk or roll or scoot along. You've probably seen kids rolling by with these heelys, like at the airport. It turns out they may not be so safe after all. They may not be as safe as they look. This one emergency room in Belfast documented elbow, ankle, and head injuries from the heelys. They suggested that kids wear elbow pads and helmets, which is really not a bad idea. I don't know if we can get the majority of kids using these to wear them. The problem, as I see it, is that kids wear these heely shoes in places and use them where it's unlikely that they're going to wear a helmet, like at the airport. I have seen kids rolling along the street on heelys listening to an iPod and not paying any attention, which is a whole other problem. Just being aware of the risks with heelys should probably wake parents up. Speaking of iPods, there was one municipality, I believe it was New York City, that was considering banning iPods in certain circumstances. I know I rollerblade quite a bit, and I'll have an iPod type headset on, and all of a sudden somebody will be honking behind me and I will have no idea I'm in the middle of the street and not paying attention. So it does lead to some serious injuries. Now, Susie, as parents, do you think that it's possible that we can get kids to wear helmets or elbow pads with these heelys?
Well, I think you'll always be able to get some parents to do that, but I think just like seeing kids on bikes and kids on rollerblades out and about, you see some with the helmets on and some without. So I think a lot of this comes down from what the parents are enforcing or not with their own kids.
Next up is an interesting piece on, does physicians' clothing and attire really matter to patients? And it was a recent study. They stated whether a doctor wears business attire, casual clothing, or scrubs seems to make little difference in a patient's satisfaction with treatment. The results of a new survey says, quote, "This contradicts the long-standing belief that attire affects the level of patient comfort or the patient's perception of physician competence and professionalism, says the lead author. Now, many years ago, I remember that this was looked at maybe not formally, and it was felt that if physicians look clean and scrubbed and their clothes were neat, they didn't necessarily have to have a tie for men, and maybe even jeans were okay for men and women. But there are limits. Sandals, I think, are a problem. Inappropriate short skirts are a problem. Men with open, you don't want the young doctor with an open chest with gold chains coming at you when you're lying there in the hospital. A lot of it is common sense. I do tend to wear a tie every day, although I don't wear that awful lab coat. Part of it is I think that what separates humans from the animals is the ability to accessorize. And men can't accessorize. What do we have? We have a tie, maybe a watch. So at least I can change my tie every day. But I think that people, despite this article, do expect some level of professionalism as far as attire. Susie, what do you think about this attire business?
Well, I agree that, you know, I think people should, I'm glad to hear that people aren't judging their doctors by what they're wearing and still feeling that they have belief that the doctors are doing what they need to. Although I would say that if I was going in for open heart surgery, I don't think I'd like to see my doc wearing a Hawaiian shirt. You know, in some ways, seeing them wear the appropriate things at the appropriate times, say like scrubs, which they would have to wear in surgery, certainly makes sense. But no, I think it's okay that they wear what's comfortable, as long as you feel like you've got, you know, you're with the right doctor and they're doing what they need to do to help you.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I had an old buddy who said when he's lying there in the hospital and looking up, he really doesn't want to see a young, tanned guy with an open shirt and gold chains sticking out looking like he just stepped off the golf course. He wants to see some guy who's thin and looks like he's been in the hospital for 36 straight hours and spends all his time studying medicine and is not stepping right off the golf course. But doctors have changed. You know, unfortunately, I've seen in residents and med students more of a, and younger physicians, more of a tendency to think of medicine as 9-to-4 and their shift workers. And it's a big problem. You know, we used to think of it as 24/7. It was a calling and a profession, and it really has changed. Suze?
I think these days, as we are all getting older, I think more of what we all must deal with is seeing how, as we're getting older, our doctors somehow seem to be getting younger and younger. A couple years ago, my sister and I were in the hospital visiting my dad, and a resident came in, and we were blown away by how young he looked. He must have been about 28, 29. He looked like he was about 23.
You know, as one of my patients said, you know you're getting older when all your doctors start looking younger than your kids. You know, some of the new docs coming out, maybe it's because I'm getting older. I'm 52, but some of them do look younger than Doogie Howser, and it is a problem. You hope that they can connect. And, of course, if you're seeing a surgeon or you're seeing certain types of doctors, it's not as crucial. You're generally there for procedures, but to connect and talk about your life and emotions for somebody who's a bit older to try to connect, it's hard for a 27-year-old physician to always connect. Now for our favorite section, the email from listeners. Our email is Doc Larry Robbins, DocLarryRobbins at AOL. And my website is headachedrugs.com. That's one long word, headachedrugs.com. The first email is from Portland, Oregon. Dr. Robbins, I've had low back pain for many years. Nothing has helped. I've tried a whole lot of things from therapy and medicine and also biofeedback. I'm on morphine, actually a long-acting version of morphine. Will this have long-term side effects? And, you know, as a last resort, we do use sometimes the long-acting opioids, which means they last 6, 8 hours or 16 or 24 hours, longer than the 2 or 3 hours that codeine or Vicodin last. And there's a lot of them. There's long-acting morphines, which some of the names are Avinza and Cadian. There's OxyContin. There's methadone. There's a patch called the Duragesic patch. And there's pluses and minuses to these. Mostly the pluses are that they can help pain and quality of life and get people functioning better. The minuses are addiction potential. They can make you tired, constipated. They're difficult to obtain. You have to go in at least every month or two. And in my experience, with the long-acting opioids, about 20% of patients do well long-term for at least 9 months. But for those 20%, they can be life-saving and really save people's quality of life. I think one key is patient selection. If people are highly addictive, we don't want to use these. If people are very tired and constipated to begin with, it might be a problem. But I'm more likely to use the opioids, the narcotic type of pain medicines, in older people. Because as people get older, after age 50, 60, their brain changes so that they don't get as used to these medicines. We call it tolerance. So if I put somebody age 25 on OxyContin, dollars to donuts, in 6 months or in 3 months, they're going to need 3 times as much OxyContin. If I put a 60-year-old on that, very often for 10 years, they'll stay on the same dose. And that's crucial. You don't want to have to keep increasing the doses of these meds. Now, our next email is from Ann Arbor. Susie Robbins, my 18-year-old daughter's a high school senior, and she's fairly depressed for about 3 months, but at the moment she won't see anyone for it. Do you have any suggestions?
Yeah, that's tough. I can understand that with adolescents. You know, many times they don't want to see a doctor or a therapist. I would certainly stay, you know, continue to try to get them to see somebody and give them lots of options. Maybe this young person, she's still in high school, maybe you could see if she would be willing to see a high school social worker, at least to begin with, so she could see somebody right at school. Many kids don't want to see a social worker at school because they feel like that labels them. I think I would at least insist on trying to get her in just to see a doctor for a physical checkup, just to make sure that physically everything's okay. And maybe if you could get her in to see her regular doctor for a physical checkup, maybe you could discuss with the doctor that maybe he or she could talk to her about maybe seeing somebody else, or at least talking to her about this depression. Because certainly she probably needs to be evaluated for medicine, and also she needs some support to be seeing somebody. I would also encourage her to exercise, because certainly just exercising typically makes everybody feel a little bit better. But I would really stay with her and really, really, in whatever way you can, get her in to see somebody.
Thank you, Susie. Susie Robbins is my co-host and is a social worker who has worked with adolescents. Now, I think that insight varies quite a bit. Some kids, even at age 18, like your daughter, have a lot of insight. Some have none into themselves and depression. Insight is how much people are really aware of themselves and their condition. Many people are severely depressed but don't accept it at all, or never accept anything about themselves, or are aware of anything. And without insight, it's tough. You can get people into therapy, but they just sit there and they don't get it, and it doesn't work very well. But I think that some people are ready later on. If we push kids into therapy, it's good if they find a good therapist. You always want somebody who's in the top 10% of therapists. Mediocre or bad therapists are not really good. And therapists are just like doctors or lawyers or business executives. There's a bell-shaped curve of therapists, and you want somebody in the top 10%. By that, I mean a therapist who connects well, who's sort of a normal person, who has a lot of insight, who doesn't give goofy advice and just tell people what to do. The idea, what goes on in therapy, is therapists are really facilitators. They get people to understand by themselves what the issues and problems are, it's not as if they're giving advice. People always say to me when I recommend a therapist, they say, well, I have good friends, but it's different. It's really quite a bit different. It's not just going to somebody for advice. Susie?
I agree with you. You do want to find the best therapist available, just like you'd want to find a doctor, a medical doctor that's going to work well with you. And, you know, sometimes the phone book, you know, is useful for many things, but maybe not, you know, for, say, finding a therapist. I would suggest word of mouth. Ask people you know and trust, hey, do you know of somebody in the area that that's a good therapist? Or say you don't want to talk to people personally about this, you know, maybe start with your own family physician and get some recommendations. But I would try to stay clear of the phone book and try to get some recommendations from people.
Yeah, personal recommendations on doctors or therapists are always the best. Or from your doctor, sometimes the doctor's staff or the physician's assistant can give you a good recommendation. Our next email is from Las Vegas, and it says, Dr. Robbins, I disagree with you about ADD. Now, previously we've talked about attention deficit disorder, which is a real condition that affects almost 5% of the population. And this email says, Dr. Robbins, isn't ADD just a convenient way of classifying our kids who won't sit still or have too much energy, particularly the boys or the kids who won't fit into our rigid school system? Well, you know, I think that maybe some kids are overdiagnosed, and this is a valid argument that has been made, but ADD really is very real. The argument always has been, well, when depression medicines came along like Prozac, they just made up that we all had depression because they wanted to sell their drugs, and the same with attention deficit disorder. It's turned out not to be true. Many studies have indicated that about 4.7% of adults have attention deficit disorder, ADD, and they can't concentrate, they can't do boring things, they can't start or finish things, and it leads to a great deal of dysfunction in their lives, both at home and at work. You know, the consequences for ADD are somewhat minor at age 5 or 6 and become more as you get older. Kids drop back in school, and then in their 20s with ADD, often they lose relationships and jobs and they lose their families. I think that studies have indicated that ADD is probably the most undertreated of all psychological problems, and there really are serious life-threatening consequences. For instance, and we've talked about this before, untreated versus treated ADD. Untreated at age 18 or so, there's a 10 times increased chance of car accidents, of behavioral problems and drug abuse, and also later on of going to jail with untreated ADD. The jails are full of people with untreated ADD. That's not the only problem, but it's one of them. Susie?
Well, as you're suggesting, there are so many costs to having untreated ADD, and I'm thinking, what about also additional alcohol and or drug abuse, you know, due to the individual's frustration, depression, and other feelings that come with it.
Now, our final email from Winnetka, Illinois. Dr. Robbins and Susie, my 15-year-old daughter recently was discovered to be smoking marijuana with her friends. I'm not sure how much she smokes, but I'm really worried, is it really a gateway to the stronger drugs? Well, as far as marijuana in adolescence, it's a problem from several standpoints. The marijuana now is much stronger than 25 years ago, pound for pound, and we used to not think of marijuana as so much of a gateway. It was a much milder effect, but the THC levels now, THC is the active ingredient, tetrahydrocannabinol, and as an aside, the cannabinoids, which are related to this, have a great future as drugs for addiction, but for pain and possibly moods as well. But being so much stronger now, I think that studies have indicated that frequent marijuana use may be a gateway. We didn't used to think so, but I think that it depends how you interpret the studies. If you look at people who are strung out on drugs in their 20s, almost all of them smoked quite a bit of marijuana as adolescents. But there are legions of people who smoke. The majority of kids who smoke don't graduate onto hard drugs. They just drink in college and smoke some and then end up okay. So it's really difficult to know. But I think that the other problems with marijuana at age 15, 16 are the big problems of motivation. It kills motivation. And some kids really do cross the line into addiction with the marijuana. And addiction to any drug, really, whether it's alcohol, marijuana, etc., is generally loosely defined practically as, is it significantly affecting work or social or family life? And in school, work would be school life. So does the marijuana smoking greatly significantly affect her social life, or more importantly, probably her school life? Now, my co-host Susie worked with kids, adolescents who were had drug problems. What do you think about marijuana at age 15?
Well, I think that kids and their parents, 15-year-old kids versus their parents, for the most part, are going to view it very differently. That the kids are going to say, it's not allowing me to blow off school and to not care about my homework. That it's this drug that just helps me to relax on the weekends. But another piece of this that that the teens really cannot argue with is that there's a medical risk to smoking marijuana. Marijuana has carcinogens in it, just as tobacco cigarettes do. So, you know, long-term smoking of marijuana, you're also going to have lung problems. And I think that there's going to be serious medical problems down the road for kids that, or can be medical problems for kids down the road who have smoked a lot of marijuana.
That's a great point, the long-term effects of marijuana. First on memory and the brain. Now, the good news is long-term studies have indicated that, at least on memory for long-time smokers, once they quit, within a month or two, their memory sort of goes back to normal, and that was actually a comforting study. But the long-term effects of putting smoke into your lungs is not great. The only good news is, of course, people tend to smoke less blunts or doobies or marijuana cigarettes than actual cigarettes.
And I think another issue that has always been at the forefront with kids and with discussing marijuana with them is the fact, is marijuana addictive or not? Many kids will say, but it's not addictive. It's not like taking cocaine or shooting up heroin that I can stop at any time. And I don't really have the real answer to that, but I think, if anything, marijuana can sneak up on somebody, and while they may not be totally addicted to it as they would be with another drug, there's certainly a desire or a psychological need to continue to smoke it.
Well, absolutely. I think if you look at physical addiction, it's relatively mild and infrequent with marijuana. But psychological addiction, sure, kids go into rehab and need, they get addicted to smoking it every day, and it does greatly affect school life. You know, I mentioned before, and I've talked about this before, it's the decreased motivation, not just in school kids, but people in their 20s. We see a lot of kids whose lives are sort of the same at age 25 as it was at age 18. They're working at dead-end jobs because they haven't gotten it together to get off marijuana and get some motivation, and I think it does impact motivation. Well, that wraps up today's program. Join us every week on the Dr. Robbins Show, and you can email us at DocLarryRobbins@AOL.com. That's DocLarryRobbins@AOL.com. Our website is headachedrugs.com. I'm Dr. Larry Robbins. I'm a neurologist physician near Chicago. And my co-host is Susie Robbins, who's a social worker. See you next week.